This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital, Part 3, Regulatory Charade, A New Crisis in the Making. David Wessel, writing in the Wall Street Journal, called it 10 days that changed capitalism. An attribute to the wonderful book, 10 Days That Shook the World by John Reed. John Reed, of course, was referring to the Bolshevik Revolution. But Wessel is referring to the actions by the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Treasury Department to bolster Wall Street and the financial markets. He writes, "The past 10 days will be remembered as the time the U.S. government discarded a half century of rules to save American financial capitalism from collapse. On the Richter scale of government activism, the government's recent actions don't yet register at Franklin Delano Roosevelt levels. They are shrouded in technicalities and buried in a pile of new acronyms. But something big just happened. It happened without an explicit vote by Congress. And though Treasury hasn't cut any checks for housing or Wall Street rescues, billions of dollars of taxpayer money were put at risk." So writes the Wall Street Journal. What did happen? First, over the St. Patrick's Day weekend, the Fed, that is, the lender of last resort, referring to the Federal Reserve, forced the sale of Bear Stearns, the fifth largest U.S. investment bank. It forced the sale to J.P. Morgan Chase. Now, we say forced the sale. We should say negotiated the sale. J.P. Morgan Chase is getting a bonanza with the acquisition of the fifth largest U.S. investment bank. The Fed wanted the price to be so low at $2 a share, $239 billion of securities, that there was a shareholder rebellion, the shareholders being the employees of Bear Stearns, that prompted J.P. Morgan to raise the price. It raised the price to $10 a share, but the Fed still agreed to take on the losses, and that is the $29 billion of securities in Bear Stearns' portfolio that essentially had no value on the open market. The Fed didn't stop there. It lent directly to Wall Street securities firms for the first time, invoking a special part of the Depression-era legislation. That is, it lent to investment banks and other Wall Street firms who aren't under the Federal Reserve stricture, like commercial banks are. That is, they don't have rules and regulations monitored by the Federal Reserve. In the first 3 days of this new era, writes Wessel, securities firms borrowed an average of $31.3 billion a day from the Fed. That's not small change, he remarks, and it's why Mr. Paulson, referring to the Treasury Secretary, after the fact, is endorsing changes to give the Fed more access to these firms' books. What is this access to which David Wessel is referring? It's a blueprint that the Treasury Secretary revealed, a blueprint of his proposals to further deregulate, that is right, not regulate, but deregulate the financial markets. Ralph?
Well, Maya, the subtitle of this article, 10 Days That Changed Capitalism, as you so rightly say, it evokes the extraordinary, breathtaking, moment-to-moment evocation of the Bolshevik Revolution, the rising of the Russian masses that transformed both Tsarist Russia and, in fact, change the world. And it's by no means an accident that the Wall Street Journal invokes the revolutionary journalism of John Reed in its title, 10 Days That Changed Capitalism. And what is the subtitle? Officials improvise to rescue markets. Will it be enough? And that's the critical issue here, because they are virtually admitting that they are stabbing in the dark and that the actual agenda is the precise opposite of what it purports to be. There is no regulatory effort here to contain, control, and to tame the rampant bubble-like fictive capital on which capitalism has depended virtually since the Roosevelt era. The pump priming of John Maynard Keynes during the so-called New Deal was nothing more than an addiction to arms production, waste production, and deficit financing for capital as actual productive forces were phased out. Real manufacturing base eradicated as capitalism found itself unable to sustain the profits that it likes, the profits that it needs, the imperial conquest that it on which it depends, based on manufacture and the actual production of real value in the economy.
Ralph, a further step that the government took was, instead of tightening the market, instead of saying, okay, Wall Street, okay, banks, you got caught because you didn't have enough capital, enough assets in on hand in your deposits and to cover when loans were due, when you didn't, when there were failures of some of your securities, the securities that were based on subprime mortgages and other mortgages and other derivative securities. Instead, what the government has done is allow institutions such as Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac that consolidate mortgages and create some of these securities on which the large institutions are trading. Instead, it allows them to raise capital by lowering the amount of money, the amount of assets that they have to keep on hand. In other words, it allows them to increase their leverage so they can buy about $200 billion more in these mortgage-backed securities, these mortgage-backed securities that are becoming worthless as there are more and more foreclosures. There are right now 1 million foreclosed homes, and it's expected that there might be another 1 million foreclosed homes soon to happen as more of these adjustable rate mortgages leave their fixed rate and go on the market. Ralph?
Well, that's the whole point, because capitalism is an anarchic quest for endless profits, no matter the consequences, deepening exploitation, ravaging the social and economic infrastructure of the society. And the government regulator allows them, says this Wall Street article, to increase their leverage so they can buy, as you mentioned, $200 billion more in mortgage-backed securities. But as the Wall Street Journal states, everybody knows that when Fannie and Freddie stumble, the taxpayers will get stuck with the tab. That means that the next crisis will be bailed out on an even greater scale, except that as the crisis deepens, there ain't going to be nothing with which to bail out. The federal regulator, the low-profile federal home loan banks, are even less well-capitalized than Fannie and Freddie. And yet they are going to be allowed to buy twice as many Fannie and Freddie blessed mortgages as previously permitted, another $100 billion worth. And what does the Wall Street Journal admit? It's messy, uncomfortable, undoubtedly flawed, like firefighters rushing to a five-alarm fire. The policies makers are making mistakes that will be apparent only in retrospect. But regardless, the clear and present danger that this virus in housing, mortgage, and credit markets is infecting the overall economy is too great to ignore. The Great Depression was worsened because the initial government reaction was wrong-headed, and they spent, referring here to Ben Bernanke, the Fed chairman, he spent an academic career trying to learn how to avoid repeating those mistakes. What does that mean in reality? There is an enormous gap, between these rates of mortgages and the sickly housing market, an enormous gap between the actual capital base for all this speculation and the real value that can be ascribed to this fictive capital. Because what are they doing to get themselves out of this crisis? They're deepening, as you indicated, the leveraging of paper shuffling, the leveraging of paper products on which they speculate and in which they attempt to produce more value, which is not there. Again, the gap remains enormous by historical standards. And it's money markets are under stress. The banks and others hoard cash. And the super safe short-term treasuries among them. Is it enough? Quote, probably not. The downward tug on the overall economy persists. The next step is almost sure to require the explicit use of taxpayer money. This is an admission that what they are doing now under the name of regulation is letting the thing run amok. Quote, in ordinary times, a capitalist economy lets prices like homes, mortgage-backed securities, and stocks fall to the point where the big bucks crowd rushes in hoping to make a killing. But if the big buck money remains on the sidelines, unpersuaded that the bottom is near, the wait for bargain hunters to take the plunge will be long and very painful. So the next step, no matter how it is dressed up, is to involve the government moving in ways to put a floor on the prices, hoping to limit the downside risk so more are willing to buy and deeper pocket investors are willing to lend them the money to do so. What is the criterion here? Scavenging. Looking for how you get in and use the crisis to deepen your profits, to scoop up things at a dollar for a $100 value, at 1/100 of the real of the prior value. This is not a formula for stabilization. This is creating an even greater bubble than that which created the crisis of the moment. And the Wall Street Journal, when you read it carefully, is admitting that the 10 days that changed capitalism are by no means 10 days invoked by chance. They are invoking the 10 days that shook the world because the change of capitalism is one of deepening crisis preparing for the revolutionary upsurge to follow.
In fact, Ralph, what the capitalist economy did, in other words, its political structure, the government, in this case the U.S. government, did is what the bourgeois governments have always been doing. They prop up the financial markets. And in this case, they provided the backing to keep the financial markets running what they hope smoothly and to show a confidence so that the private markets would inject capital into these failing banks and other financial institutions. The same way as Friedrich Engels wrote, in the development of capitalism, it was the governments that provided the infrastructure. The governments have provided the roads and the railroads and propped up all the basic infrastructure elements of the economy. And that is how the capitalists could then focus on the development of their industries.
Energy, transport, all, as you say, of the infrastructure is supplied by the state, milking the public. And it's designed to sustain and underwrite the oligarchy, the ruling class. David Stock, he coined the phrase the corporate soup line, candidly acknowledging that what the Communist Manifesto lays out is very clear, that the state is but the vehicle for sustaining the capitalist ruling class, and it is just the state is run by the executive committee of the capitalist class to subsidize itself and to sustain its dictatorship. It's the dictatorship of capital that pays for and controls the political process and that owns the state, which is but a facade for sustaining its rule and providing the coercive instrument for maintenance of that rule, police, Army, intelligence services, and the apparatus of repression. But Maya, let's look for a moment, because the Wall Street Journal has to dance around this reality, even though to give credit where credit is due, the financial journals of capital, from the Financial Times to the Wall Street Journal to Business Week to U.S. News and World Report to Bloomberg News, are writing it accurately. They are describing a reality they usually disguise. They may use euphemisms, but you cannot mistake the reality that is coming through their pages. And in the New York Times article of March 30th, in Treasury Plan, A Reluctant Eye Over Wall Street, Nelson Schwartz and Floyd Norris spell it out even more clearly.
Ralph, we should mention that the plan they're talking about is the plan that was announced by Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson Jr. on Monday. And this is his blueprint for financial regulatory reform. This blueprint, the executive summary, is available on the internet, is a year in the making, and it is the response of Paulson, who at one time was the chair of Goldman Sachs, in the same way that the former Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin also was ahead of Goldman Sachs, the largest Wall Street investment stock brokerage firm. And today we have Paulson coming out with a blueprint that, instead of regulating markets, responds to the request of commercial banks such as Citigroup to deregulate the financial markets. And the biggest part, which they're talking about, is the taking over of the Federal Reserve, just doing what it just did, being the avenue of last resort for the financial markets, and in a crisis, bolstering up the capitalist economy.
Well, you see, what is so absurd about this is that the regulatory agency, whether it's the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is manned by the very captains of capital, they all come from Bear Stearns, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Citigroup. These are the bankers and the stockbrokers, the captains of capital, who are then regulating themselves. And the article states the Bush administration is proposing the broadest overhaul of Wall Street regulation since the Great Depression. But the plan to be unveiled on Monday, writes Nelson Schwartz and Floyd Norris, has its genesis in the year-long effort to limit Washington's role in the market. That DNA is unmistakably evident in the fine print, they admit. The proposal would impose the first regulation of hedge funds and private equity funds, but that oversight will have a light touch, enabling the government to do little beyond collecting information. The regulatory umbrella created in the 1930s would grow wider with power concentrated in fewer agencies, but their authority will be limited, doing virtually nothing to regulate the many new financial products whose unwise use has been the culprit in the current financial crisis. You can't have it more clearly stated than that. This is a charade. This is the antithesis of regulation. This is the concentration of decision-making in even fewer hands, but the same hands that created the financial crisis to begin with. The plan hands vast new authority to the Federal Reserve, essentially formalizing what had been an improvised process over the last 3 weeks. But some fear that the central bank's role in creating the mess undercuts its ability to clean it up. All the checks and balances in this plan reflect the mindset of its architect, Treasury Secretary Henry M. Paulson Jr., who comes to Washington after a long career on Wall Street. He is worried that any effort to substantially tighten regulation hampers the ability of American markets to compete with foreign rivals. As to the full effect of the credit crisis, as it becomes clearer, these political stakes are growing, and Paulson is clearly taking a stand against critics who call for stricter regulation, rejecting any notion that the crisis in financial markets and the collapse of Bear Stearns can be laid at the administration's doorstep. In a draft of his speech, he declares, It is not fair or accurate to blame our regulatory structure for the current turmoil. And he further argues, the New York Times makes clear, the current regulatory structure is outdated, echoing the traditional Republican view that new rules and agencies are no substitute for the market disciplining itself. So what do we have here? The proposal creates a set of federal regulators with nominal authority of the over the players in the financial system, banks, insurance companies, and the entities such as hedge funds and private equity funds. And here is what the Times states, but that authority is critically limited. The Fed, which Paulson proposes to make the market stability regulator, would be given explicit authority to limit the risks financial institutions take regarding certain asset classes and to address liquidity and funding issues, but only in an advisory capacity and after the fact. In short, these are the very problems that cause the nation's banks and brokerage firms tens of billions of dollars. So it's going to be the same old, what the article in the New York Times calls an alphabet soup of unregulated products cooked up by financial engineers, such as the collateralized debt obligations, the CDOs, and the CDS credit default swaps, the same phenomenon that's created the crisis over which this nominal regulatory response is being made, a regulatory response that is the exact opposite of what it purports to be.
Ralph, you mentioned the New York Times putting the blame on Republican administrations, but it was during the Clinton administration that Glass-Steagall Act, which had been passed in 1933 in response to the swindling and fraud by major banks and financial houses, and the Glass-Steagall Act made it illegal for a commercial bank, which has consumer deposits, to function as an investment bank, in other words, and as an underwriter of corporate offerings and securities, in other words, funny money. And it was the Glass-Steagall Act, which was overturned in 1999 under the Clinton administration, and that allowed the commercial banks to create these off-balance sheet investment securities, to trade in them and operate in a way like an investment bank. In other words, to the commercial banks, such as Citibank, were saying that they couldn't compete with the investment houses. And the Clinton administration responded to this by overturning the Glass-Steagall Act. So we have here a capitalist, a professor, Michael Greenberger of the University of Maryland, who was a senior official of the Commodity Futures Trading Commission during the Clinton administration, saying in response to the proposals such as Paulson and to the past action of the Federal Reserve that the Fed, in fact, oversaw the meltdown. And his response of putting more power in the Federal Reserve is, quote, this is the equivalent of the builders of the Maginot Line giving lessons on defense.
And that's a reference, Maya, to the purported invulnerable defense of the French military against invasion, the Maginot Line, which, of course, was breached in a matter of days by the Wehrmacht.
In World War One.
In World War Two, my dear.
In World War Two. The Fed's former chairman, Alan Greenspan, for years praised the growth in the derivatives market as a boon for market stability. And he resisted calls to use the Federal Reserve's power to increase regulation of the mortgage market. He always said the market would find its own corrections. And so here we have the capitalists themselves, the bourgeois professors, pointing out that capitalism oversees the meltdown. It doesn't regulate itself. We should discuss what Paulson's proposals actually were, proposals that he put forth on Monday.
We should do, but let me just mention this, Maya, because what's instructive about this is that the functionaries, whether they're Republicans or Democrats, are on the same page. For example, Representative Scott Garrett of New Jersey, a Republican on the House Financial Services Committee, says, I want market discipline, but you don't do it by empowering the Fed. We're trying to get transparency from an institution that's not transparent in its own workings. And in fact, under the Treasury proposal, the Fed would have authority to stop financial institutions from taking on too much risk, but little would be done to limit the flow of these new products. This is a quote from the New York Times. Little will be done to limit the flow of such new products. What are the new products? Exactly these unregulated products, these collateralized debt obligations, the credit default swaps, all of the invented categories of speculative leveraged
derivatives
that are the source of the collapse, because they are completely fictive in their character, based on no sustainable value, and ultimately doomed to collapse like a house of cards.
And Ralph, it isn't regulation, because when you look at what Paulson is proposing, he's saying that the Federal Reserve would step in as a last resort. In other words, when there's a crisis, just as it did in the case of Bear Stearns, where the government said, oops, we think that Bear Stearns is interlinked with all the other financial companies, being the fifth largest investment firm. And if Bear Stearns, which had two of its derivatives funds go under, if it's going to go under, in other words, if it can't borrow any more money from the other capitalist institutions and is itself going in, leading towards bankruptcy, then this will have an impact on the other financial institutions. So we better prop it up. And that's what the Federal Reserve did. Just like in prior years, the Federal Reserve stepped in and bailed out the savings and loans institutions, costing the U.S. taxpayers $240 billion.
And my even more to the point, who the hell do you think was promoting the subprime mortgages and this total exploitation of poor people? It was Greenspan, the head of the Fed. The Democratic celebrated head of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, was the greatest hype person and pimp for these very instruments, especially the derivatives market, especially that. As Greenberger says, turning over this responsibility to the Fed doesn't address the derivatives problem at all. On the contrary, it is, in fact, the fox guarding the hen house, as we've often said. But what is the response of the Democrats? They react with praise. It's a recognition that you have to enhance the regulations, said Representative Barney Frank, the chair of the House Financial Services Committee, the Massachusetts Democrat. Guess what? The chair of the House Financial Services Committee had applauded Alan Greenspan, had applauded the subprime market, had applauded the derivatives processes, the speculative bubble on Wall Street, all the time that it was happening, praised by Republicans and Democrats alike without restraint. Maya.
Ralph, the basis of the Paulson plan, the Treasury Secretary's plan, is instead of the regulatory agencies having strict regulatory control, there would be principles established, and there would also be self-regulating organizations. In other words, let Wall Street monitor itself, and then the government would have principles that it would look at to see whether Wall Street was doing that. Well, that is a bit bizarre. And then the government would step in as the last resort to prop up the financial markets should they be in trouble. So we have here actually a proposal for complete deregulation.
And propping up means once again milking the taxpayer if there's anything left to milk.
And the Securities and Exchange Commission, which is supposedly maintaining orderly stock and bond markets and protecting investors, little it does, In fact, it would be combined with the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, which regulates the exchange-traded futures for oil, grains, currency, and the like, and has less regulatory power than the SEC. And what Paulson is proposing is that you combine these two agencies and that you downgrade the SEC regulations and follow the regulations of the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital, Part 3, Regulatory Charade, A New Crisis in the Making. Ralph?
Paulson stated the following. He said that the long-term proposals he is making should not be acted upon while the current market stresses remain severe. He stated no decision should be made this month or even this year. Next year, of course, there'll be a new president in office. In other words, this supposed intervention represents a call for doing absolutely nothing during the current crisis. That means in practice that the laissez-faire character of the administration and with support from the Democrats will be sustained. Robert J. Pickle, chief executive of the International Swaps and Derivatives Association, said, "This report will help streamline and improve the competitiveness of America's financial services sector." And the New York Times comments, "The Paulson proposal will not give regulators new powers over investment banks. The prudential regulator would not have any authority. There's no explicit guarantee. The Fed would be expected to step in and limit risk-taking only after the stability of the financial system was threatened." The report drew praise from the hedge fund industry. "The general tone is positive," said Richard Baker, senior Republican member of the House Financial Services Committee, now chief executive of the Managed Funds Association. It's the same bunch. These are the folks who are the authors of the crisis. These are the people who are in the regulatory role. Got the picture? Christopher Fox, the chairman of the SEC, also backs the proposal. "The need for better integration of financial services in the United States has never been clearer," he said. Yeah, integrated under their same control for a further sanctioning of the next bubble and the next speculation and the next enrichment, right on to the point of collapse.
Well, let's look at the specifics. The proposals are in near, intermediate, and long-term proposals. That's how it's divided into these three stages. What to do now, what to do in the near future, and what to do in the long term. Of course, these are proposals proposed by the Wall Street interests. And as you remark, Ralph, there's a new administration probably in the works with a Democratic victory expected, and this will be shelved. But the congressmen, the congresspeople, are looking at very similar proposals, such as those made by Secretary Paulson's team. The intermediate recommendations, while giving the Federal Reserve the right to step in a crisis, actually eliminate the day-to-day oversight that the Fed has over commercial banks and instead gives an expanded power to the array of financial institutions and markets because the Fed would only inspect the books of any bank, investment bank, hedge fund, and private equity firm or insurance company. That is, it looks like it's expanding the power of the Fed because it's allowing it to look at private equity firms and hedge funds and insurance companies. But it only can do so if there is a crisis, what is called a systemic threat to the financial system. And the current role of overseeing commercial banks and the depository institutions would be taken over by the prudent financial regulator. And this is a regulator that only has broad principles, not specific regulatory power.
Here's how the International Herald Tribune, in its article on March 31st by Stephen Labaton and Michael Grunbaum, spelled it out. Ambitious plan to overhaul financial system surveillance? As Henry Paulson, Jr., Treasury Secretary, laid out this plan to overhaul the regulatory apparatus, senior lawmakers and industry lobbyists predicted most of it will be dead on arrival. That's how the article begins. Most of it will be dead on arrival. It's a wild pitch, said Senator Christopher Dodd, the Connecticut Democrat. Using a baseball metaphor, he's the head of the Senate Banking Committee. It's not even close to the strike zone. Paulson stressed the measures are intended to address long-term problems rather than create a quick fix. By his own account, he and other senior officials, the Herald Tribune continues, have urged lawmakers not to act on the proposal until the crisis is over. This will move the timetable for any improvement long after a new president enters the White House. And as we've been indicating this before, but here's how the Herald Tribune characterizes it. Senator Paulson has been working on this package for about a year. It's not like pulling a rabbit out of a hat, Vanna Perino, the White House press secretary, told reporters. The administration's proposal will do nothing to regulate the alphabet soup of sophisticated financial products that have fueled the current financial crisis. I continue to quote. It will not rein in the practices that have been linked to the mortgage crisis, like packaging risky loans into securities carrying the highest ratios. Hedge funds and private equity firms, which have enjoyed freedom from government oversight for years, that oversight will be minimal, enabling the government to do little beyond collecting information until a wide-scale financial crisis has already occurred, quote, unquote. What could be more clear, brothers and sisters? It's a con game. It's a charade, as Maya has been saying. It is a proposal for giving a free hand to the speculators, for creating even more daring instruments of bubble-like speculation in order to create the facade of injection of capital. Of course, that's bailouts from taxpayers, but only waiting for the next crisis on an even greater scale. So there you have the most clear indication that the charade has a clear message to us. The captains of capital and their spokespersons in the state power in Congress, whatever, don't have a clue about what to do. And there's a simple reason for it, brothers and sisters. Under capitalism, there is nothing to be done. Late capital has no answer but deficit finance speculation. Production is not any longer an engine of sufficient profit, even with the slave labor wages that they seek around the planet. The system is in terminal crisis. Only a controlled, democratically controlled, planned economy can harness the value that we produce and utilize it to transform society, eliminating slums, eliminating the absence of health care and schools and the infrastructure of an entire society, planning for social and human need under democratic control. The anarchy of capital based on profit and exploitation leads only in the direction of one crisis after another based upon the immiseration and deepening exploitation of the masses of the world and permanent war to sustain the repressive apparatus while seizing the resources on which the speculation is even greater in its next stage.
Ralph, one aspect of the capitalist system that Paulson does point out is that the financial institutions are the minimal regulation is done on some of them by states instead of the federal government. For instance, insurance companies. Each state has its own insurance regulations, and it varies from state to state. But many of the insurance companies, in fact, the large ones, the major brokers, are national. and have regulations that differ from state to state. Paulson is suggesting that there be a federal insurance agency that would set standards. Now, the state insurance commissioners are not going to buy into that because it would mean they would be giving up some of their power. Another aspect has to do with the thrift organizations. The thrifts are the savings and loan, and they are regulated separately than commercial banks. And that you had with the savings and loan debacle years before. And what Paulson is suggesting is that the line between thrifts and commercial banks be eliminated and that they be considered in the same regulatory light. And this also is unlikely to take place given the lobbying power of each of the institutions. 50% of the subprime mortgages in the United States were issued by unregulated institutions. And that is something that Paulson notes. And he suggests that there be a mortgage origination commission, but it doesn't have regulatory power. What it would set up is a uniform minimum licensing qualification standard for the state mortgage market participants, because the mortgage markets are, for the most part, regulated state by state. That is, the people who are issuing mortgages. And this in itself wouldn't do much to correct any of the problems. And as the most important part of what he is saying, and this is why they talk about the change in capitalism, is that the Federal Reserve becomes the institution of safeguard of the capitalist process. In other words, as we've been saying over and over again, what you're talking about here from the Republican side. Now, remember, the Republicans are always saying free market, less government intervention. And what they're doing here above board is saying, yes, deregulate, no rules. Let everything be self-regulating. But should there be a crisis, the federal government will step in and prop up capitalism.
Well, Maya, just to be very clear about this mantra of no government intervention and no government subsidy and no government regulation and no government responsibility for the well-being of the population. The truth of the matter is that nothing is more socialized than the sustaining of the capitalist system. Let's take the example of the military and the Pentagon. From cradle to grave, the members of the military are subsidized. Their health care, their pensions, their salaries, their travel, their housing, everything is socialized by the government.
Universal health care.
Universal health care.
Full coverage.
For all the members of the intelligence agencies, all the members of the apparatus of repression, all the members of the military, all the members of Congress, all the satraps of capitalism who command the capitalist state are sucking on the tit of the public. That is the reality of the so-called anti-regulatory. They don't want the state to serve the masses. They want the state to be the instrument of the 1% of the population that owns and controls 95% more than the rest of us combined.
Here's the subsidies, Ralph, the subsidies to the Pentagon industries, the subsidies to the airline industry, the subsidies to the oil interests, the subsidies to the large agribusiness.
Every sector of capital is subsidized. They don't pay taxes. Their write-offs are such that they get rebates on the taxes they don't pay. Their profits are sheltered offshore. The whole thing is an absurd charade. All of this rhetoric, this ruling class ideology, the false consciousness of ruling class ideology, which tells our masses that the state should not be involved in their affairs because that will obstruct their freedom, is the diametric opposite of the reality. The state subsidizes the capitalist ruling class in every last particular. The state is its instrument. The state is its source of maintenance. The state is its vehicle for milking and bilking and subjugating the public. And here is Paul Krugman in the New York Times on March 31st. Here you have every virtue from liberal to Wall Street Journal. Here's Krugman in the New York Times in an article called The Dilbert Strategy. Anyone who has worked in a large organization who reads the comment strict Dilbert is familiar with org chart strategy. To hide the lack of any actual ideas about what to do, managers make a big show of rearranging the boxes and lines and then and that say who reports to whom. You now understand the principle behind the administration's new proposal for financial reform. It's all about the appearance, creating the appearance of responding to the current crisis without doing anything substantive. The financial events of the last 7 months and the last few weeks have convinced all but a few diehards that the U.S. financial system needs major reform or will lurch from crisis to crisis, and the crises will get bigger and bigger. The rescue of Bear Stearns was a paradigm-changing event. And he continues, when push came to shove, the Federal Reserve didn't dare let market discipline run its course and rushed to Bear's rescue, risking billions of taxpayer dollars because it feared the collapse of this major financial institution will endanger the financial system as a whole. And he continues, the Bush administration spent the last 7 years trying to do away with government oversight of the financial industry.
Ralph, again, Krugman is letting the Clinton administration.
Well, we'll come to, yes, absolutely. That's what a liberal does. I mean, it's the liberal, it's the limits of liberalism. But what's interesting is I want to emphasize here, Maya, is whether you're talking about these liberal fakers, because we'll come down to what the Democratic role in all this has been over the past several administrations. But the, I'm sorry, the interest about the limits of these liberal fakers is that they are squawking about the very things that they've been promoting, supporting, and implementing. And as he says, Krugman, to his credit, says this, the new plan, conceived as promoting competitive financial services sector leading the world, that's banker speak, he says, for getting rid of regulations that annoy big financial operators. It is what he calls a camouflage. He says, sure enough, according to the executive summary of the plan, regulation is limited to institutions that receive explicit federal guarantees, that is, institutions already regulated, that are not the source of the problem. All the rest, the report blithely declares, will be left to market discipline as the only effective tool to limit systemic risk.
SRO, self-regulating organization.
So this is what he says. They are rearranging the boxes on an organizational chart. OCC, OTS, CFTC, PFRA, CBRA, whatever, he writes. Will arranging these boxes make any difference? I'm disappointed to say it will make none at all.
Ralph,
the truth is that that's not what's happening. The regulators actually are not being put into any place. He says, when you look at this, when you look at what's really going on, America's financial crises are getting bigger. The market disruption that followed the collapse of long-term capital management was considered a major scary event. Compared with the current earthquake, the LTCM crisis was a minor tremor. The next crisis will be even bigger, and I, for one, don't want to live through a replay of the 1930s. Thank you very much, Paul Krugman. The Dilbert strategy is exactly what we're looking at here.
Ralph, I actually think it's deeper than a Dilbert strategy. The Dilbert strategy is where you're shuffling around organizations so it looks as if you're appearing to make change and you're not. And what Paulson is proposing and what the, it's not just Paulson, it's really what the big financial interests such as Citigroup are proposing is further deregulation. In other words, let the market do what it wants and make it policy, not just ad hoc intervention, but make it policy that the Federal Reserve become the market stability regulator. That's the term used by Paulson, market stability regulator. In other words, that the federal government automatically steps in and props up capitalism, that there's no discussion about it. There's no congressional debate that whether or not you're going to bail out Chrysler or whether or not you're going to bail out the savings and loan. In fact, it goes out of congressional discussion, and it becomes the purpose of this private, semi-private institution run by bankers, the Federal Reserve, to have market stability regulation.
Well, Maya, let's take a look at the analysis of the World Socialist website, which draws on some of the material that we've been citing here and does a rather nice job in synopsizing what the realities are with a particular focus. And the headline of this article on March 29th by Barry Gray is, Clinton, Obama, and McCain defer to Wall Street. After months of virtual silence on the collapse of the speculative binge on Wall Street that plunged the U.S. economy into recession, all three major U.S. presidential candidates delivered speeches this week on the housing and credit crises. Last week's failure of Bear Stearns, the government underwritten buyout of the investment bank by J.P. Morgan Chase, evoking widespread comparisons to the financial breakdown that ushered in the Great Depression, was the precipitant factor, obliging Democrats Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and Republican John McCain to address the turmoil on Wall Street. Among the Democratic candidates in particular, specific electoral calculations play a role. The next major primary on April 22nd in Pennsylvania, an industrial state that is devastated by plant closures, impacted by the epidemic of home disclosures, in fact, over 200,000 jobs lost in that one state, have precipitated the need to appear to address the problem. But here's what they say. It took a near meltdown of the U.S. financial system to prod the candidates to even address the panic-gripping financial markets. Clive Crook devoted an entire article in the March 24th Financial Times on the reticence of the presidential contenders. He wrote, "The separation of presidential politics from the real problems assailing the United States economy is verging on the surreal. Banks collapsing, the dollar reeling, the Federal Reserve making up new rules as it goes, and observers discussing a new Great Depression, and the candidates are still on scripts they wrote a year ago." Well, what is this really about? Here is how it plays out. The speeches by Clinton, Obama, and McCain demonstrate the subservience of all three candidates in both major parties to the United States financial elite. Senator Clinton spoke Monday in Philadelphia and outlined her plan to address housing and financial crises. Her relation to Wall Street is best summed up by her proposal of an emergency working group on foreclosures to be headed by a, quote, distinguished nonpartisan group of economic leaders, Alan Greenspan, Robert Rubin, and Paul Volcker. Who are they? Greenspan, the chairman of the Federal Reserve during the Bill Clinton administration, is a free market advocate of financial deregulation and an open admirer of Ayn Rand. He sponsored the creation of the housing and credit bubbles that have now burst by repeatedly cutting interest rates and rejecting proposals by one of the Fed governors that the central bank monitor subprime mortgage lenders. Robert Rubin, the CEO of Goldman Sachs, itself on the verge of collapse, the biggest Wall Street investment bank before becoming Clinton's Treasury Secretary. He now holds the top management position, and it was Rubin, as Maya points out, who spearheaded the 1999 repeal of the Glass-Steagall Act, the cornerstone of federal banking regulation since its enactment at the height of the Great Depression. So there we have the two, and who is the third? The third that is sanctioned by Obama and by Barack Obama and by Hillary Clinton and McCain alike, Paul Volcker, appointed chair of the Federal Reserve by Democratic President Jimmy Carter in 1979, who jacked up interest rates to precipitate a severe recession and sharp rise in unemployment, and then the Fed chairman under Ronald Reagan, presiding over the most brutal offensive against the working class that took the form of union busting, cuts in social spending, tax breaks for the wealthy, sweeping deregulation of big business, the policies set in motion the redistribution of wealth from the bottom to the top, continues to the present and has produced the unprecedented levels of social inequality. Maya?
Ralph, let's look at what the Fed has already offered to Wall Street. $1 trillion in discounted loans to banks and investment houses. and the U.S. government is paying over $400 billion a year on interest on the national debt to banks and big investors. The Iraq war has been costing $144 billion annually. This is a huge subsidy to the financial markets, and it is not over yet. Using the Federal Reserve, using the money of U.S. taxpayers, the working people, driving down the living standards of working people while propping up this capitalist charade is not over yet. Today's New York Times, UBS, to write down another $19 billion. UBS, the largest Swiss bank, said on Tuesday that it would write down another $19 billion related to the U.S. real estate and other structured credit positions. The UBS write-down results in a first-quarter loss of $12 billion and it's seeking capital of $15 billion. So far, global banks have written down more than $200 billion of soured loans in the market debacle, and it is expected that there will be another $200 billion to more. This will again be propped up by the Federal Reserve. This will again be propped up on the backs of working people in the United States. Ralph, to conclude.
Barack Obama gave a speech Thursday at Cooper Union in Manhattan before a select Wall Street audience. He was warmly introduced by New York Mayor
Michael Bloomberg,
the multi-billionaire financial media mogul. And now Barack Obama, in turn, praised Bloomberg for, quote, his extraordinary leadership, unquote. And then he recognized Paul Volcker, who has endorsed Barack Obama's campaign, as has William Donaldson, the former Securities and Exchange Commission chairman. Here you have Volcker, Reagan's man, Clinton's man, the very architects of this whole catastrophe, endorsing Barack Obama, praise for their extraordinary leadership, and Obama focused his remarks on a call for financial regulatory reform while declaring his reverence for the free market, declaring, I do not believe that government can stand in the way of this innovation or turn back the clock to an era of regulation. Both parties, all candidates, subservient to the captains of capital, getting their primary finances, Obama the most, next Clinton and then McCain, from these very financial institutions and from Wall Street. This is the crisis waiting to happen. No answer from the candidates of capital, brothers and sisters, only from our own efforts for a new political reality in response to the bigger crisis yet to come.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital, Part 3, Regulatory Charade, A New Crisis in the Making, will be on our website, www.takingaimradio.com, and on the WBAI archive at wbai.org. We'll be with you next week, along with the concluding chapter of The Collapse of Bear Stearns and the Crisis of Fictive Capital, The Assault on the Working Class in the United States.